She left the winter chill of Toronto for the sizzle of Miami. Coming up, travel presenter Onika Raymond recommends her favorite neighborhoods to enjoy for a fun Miami getaway.
Wynwood is definitely the spot, and it's taking over from South Beach, I would say.
Friends from Scotland tackle the difference between genuine cultural icons and touristic cliches, and what it all means for a Scottish identity.
Ordinary people wear tartan nowadays.
Those stereotypes don't do us any harm, but they have to be seen in the context of a modern Scotland.
And singer Jim Malcolm plays tribute to Scotland's national poet, Robert Burns. Scots and their friends all around the world pay tribute each year on Burns Night, January 25th.
It's just all the good stuff. People wear the kilts, play bagpipes, people drink lots of whiskey, they eat haggis, they dance, they sing, they tell jokes.
You're invited, so come along. It's Travel with Rick Steves. Scotland is a distinct nation within Great Britain. It's got a rollicking history, breathtaking landscapes, and a delightful accent. Coming up on today's Travel with Rick Steves, Scottish friends remind us of what's special about their home turf, even if it comes with a few cultural cliches. Plus, singer Jim Malcolm pays tribute to poet Robert Burns. He's put some of Burns' lyrics to music to warm us up for a Burns Night celebration. But let's start the hour somewhere a wee bit warmer and a bit closer to home. It's sometimes called the Magic City. Miami, Florida offers a modern skyline with sizzling beaches and nightlife, generously spiced with its Cuban influences. But to really get to know Miami, you need to understand its neighborhoods as well. Our guide from Miami is Onika Raymond. Onika's a travel writer and a podcaster who travels all over. But she's with us today on Travel with Rick Steves to introduce us to her adopted hometown and to take us to some of her favorite places in her own backyard. Onika, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me, Rick.
Now, you're from Toronto, but you've relocated in Miami. Why and how and how's it going?
Have you ever experienced winter in Toronto?
I get it. I think I have something similar, yeah.
I got tired of the Canadian winters and of the cold, and so I basically absconded to Miami, and I've been way happier ever since. The weather is gorgeous here most of the year, and I love it. It's hot. There's lots of things to do. It's a beautiful place. It's great.
All right. And how long have you been there?
I've been in Miami almost 2 years now.
2 years. And are you feeling like a local yet? What do you do there to get that badge of honor that, okay, you're now a local?
You know what? I'm not entirely sure. I have been navigating these Miami streets, absolutely. I lived in New York City for 7 years before this. And I think that being able to navigate the New York subway really made me feel like a local. There isn't a subway system here in Miami, so I don't know. Maybe I need to learn how to salsa really well, and then I could say that I'm a true Miamian.
So why do people visit Miami? I mean, it's got a huge tourism industry. Is it all the beach?
Oh, my goodness. The beach is incredible, but there's so much to Miami beyond the beaches. You said it in your intro. I mean, Cuban culture is prevalent here. Hispanic and Latin culture are prevalent here, as is Caribbean culture. There's a large Jamaican population. Mm-hmm. There's a very large Haitian population here as well. So you're going to get that international flavor in this metropolitan city in the U.S.
And you could almost say that Spanglish is the language, can't you?
Oh, 100%. I tell everybody that my Spanish has greatly improved since being in Miami. I speak it every day. I speak it as much as I can. And I love that for me.
I remember being in the airport in Miami, and it just felt like this is the hub of Latin America. I mean, there were flights going direct to all different capitals in Latin America, and the airport was filled with people that go to Miami to connect and to go shopping and to get a little break from their home.
Absolutely. It's funny that you mentioned that because I actually just got back from Cancun yesterday, and it is 1 hour and 25 minutes in the air. So
amazing.
It is a very short flight to Mexico from here.
Well, let's talk about this Cuban scene, because I think that's, you know, you can go for the beach, but it would be a real shame not to connect with Cuban culture when you're in Miami.
Yes. You know, one of the easiest places to do that is in Little Havana. Along Calle Ocho, for example, there are so many bars and different areas, restaurants where you can experience Cuban culture. You know, in my podcast with Marriott Bonvoy about the journey, in season 3, we actually talked about the Miami music scene. And one of my top tips is to go to Calle Ocho. It is to go to Little Havana to listen to live music for free in Ball and Chain and some of the other restaurants and bars along that street.
Onika, I know in your travel writing and in your podcast, you talk a lot about the value of getting to know neighborhoods. So we've got Little Havana, but there's other neighborhoods that you mentioned you really need to get to know in Miami. What are some of them?
There are so many other neighborhoods apart from Little Havana that we need to get to know. Little Haiti is one of them. It's so vibrant. There's actually really great places to eat within Little Haiti. Little River is another one that's kind of springing up. We're having a lot of international cuisine, lots of little restaurants and cafes that are popping up there. And Wynwood, that's actually my neighborhood. I live within walking distance. It's always great for a good time. If you want to go out, if you want to go listen to music, if you want to go party, you want to go eat, Wynwood is definitely the spot. And it's taking over from South Beach, I would say.
Really? And Wynwood is known for its street art, isn't it?
It is very much known for street art, and it's something that I love because there's an opportunity for local artists to express themselves. People call it graffiti, but I'm really into
street art tours. I just think if you can take a street art tour, you'll learn a lot about a culture.
100%. And I think that the art scene in Miami is one that is growing and really focused on local artists as well, which I enjoy and which I think is important because it's about the community at the end of the day and what they're able to add, I guess, to the city and how they're able to elevate the city.
So we've been talking about these neighborhoods, a lot of them ethnic neighborhoods, Little Haiti, Little Cuba and so on, Little Havana. What about South Beach?
You know what? South Beach, love it or hate it, it is something it is a place that you need to explore when you come to Miami. My favorite area of the beach, I have to say, is Ocean Drive. I mean, people will kind of have their own opinion on that. But I love the Art Deco buildings that you're going to find from about 8th Street, 8th and Ocean, to about 15th Street and Ocean, along Ocean Drive. I mean, those are some of the best preserved buildings and some of the best preserved architecture in the U.S. And I think it's absolutely stunning.
Now, this is Travel with Rick Steves. We're talking with Onika Raymond. She's joining us from Miami right now as we explore Florida's magic city from a local's perspective. Onika's the host of a podcast called About the Journey, and you can also see her on Travel Channel as she's the host of Big City, Little Budget and another show called One Bag and You're Out. Her website is onikaraymond.com. That's spelled O-N-E-I-K-A, onikaraymond.com. When are the times to go to Miami, and when are the times not to go to Miami?
Well, you know what? I think Miami is beautiful and has a lot for a travel to experience at any time of year. But my personal favorite, now that I live here, is I love December and January. First of all, the weather is incredible. You're out of the hurricane season. The humidity is way down. And if you're into events, Art Basel is definitely a thing. It usually it's a very popular art festival that takes place in December typically. And it's a great time to be here. There are a lot of music festivals and food festivals that happen. The South Beach Food and Wine Festival takes place typically in January. So there's a lot of things going on. And oftentimes a lot of great free things to do as well in December and January in Miami. And in South Beach, Miami Beach.
And you mentioned that it's a good to avoid spring break. What goes on in spring break?
Yeah. So there's a lot going on in spring break. I think it depends on your demographic. I mean, totally, if you are in college, I think you kind of have to have the Miami Beach, South Beach spring break experience. If you're a little older, if you're no longer in school or you're looking for a holiday that's a bit more sedate, if we can call it that, then I would avoid spring break like the plague.
Okay, but let's talk more about the plague. I mean, what is the downside? What happens to parking? What happens to...
Oh my goodness. So first of all the prices increase. First of all, you're not going to be able to find parking. If you do find parking, it's going to be exorbitant. If you're doing rideshare, expect to pay, if not double, like triple. Wow. It's not a great time to be in the city, and I feel that Miami residents in general do not like it. However, last spring break, I will say that it's been quieter.
Didn't the city try to do something? The city took an initiative.
The city actually made a campaign deterring people from coming, and as such, they restricted, I guess, parking options, and they made it very expensive to park in South Beach, for example, or to park in the city of Miami as a deterrent. And as such, I think the campaign actually worked because I was here during spring break and I was shocked at how not busy it was, to be honest with you.
And of course, with climate change, the climate is getting a little more violent. Of course, you don't want to be there at the wrong on the wrong day if there's something very newsworthy. But just in general, with the tropical climate, afternoon rainstorms are sort of the norm now, aren't they?
I think it depends on the seasonality of it all. Typically, July, August, you're going to get a really big rainstorm, one or two rainstorms in the afternoon, kind of like clockwork. September is kind of prime hurricane season. But what I will say is that Miami, at least in the last couple of years that I've been here, doesn't seem to get hit as hard as maybe some of the surrounding areas. But definitely it gets very, very wet. And so that is something to be well aware of. I know a friend of mine almost had his bachelor party here in August, and I advised against it. I was like, don't do it. Don't do it. And sure enough, they ended up going elsewhere. And the weekend that they were thinking of coming here, it rained the entire weekend.
Wow.
Flooding is really bad in certain areas of the city, like in Brickell, for instance, and downtown. So that's just something to be really aware of when you are planning travel to South Florida.
Wow. We're getting insider tips for enjoying Miami, Florida right now on Travel with Rick Steves. Travel host Onika Raymond is based in Miami and hosts occasional podcasts from her travels at About the Journey. Onika's also produced short videos about Miami for the Big City Little Budget series at TravelChannel.com. Onika, we're just about out of time. If I had a three-day weekend in Miami, I want to spend one day in the Everglades. The other 2 days, how would I spend them?
I would say on the second day, definitely do all of South Beach, do Miami Beach, explore the beach. Because Miami Beach is actually separate from Miami mainland. And a lot of people don't realize that. They don't realize that those are two separate entities and they're actually two different cities. City of Miami is different from Miami Beach. So I would say dedicate your time to exploring Ocean Drive and doing all of that stuff in Miami Beach. And then the third day, take it to the mainland, hit up those areas that we were talking about. Definitely go to Wynwood, check out Little Haiti, eat and see a show in Little Havana. And you're good for your first visit to Miami. And hopefully it'll encourage you to come back a second time.
And if I'm going to visit you and you're going to take me to one musical event after dinner, what would it be?
You know what? I love to dance, so I'm a sucker for Little Havana.
Great.
I love it there. So,
well,
it's,
when I was
it's
in Cuba, that
vibe.
Was a highlight. Just the music, the vibe, you know.
Yeah, and the live music and people playing instruments and
you just stumble down
just
there
walk
and you
in.
Just find and you just find stuff going on
just,
everywhere.
Just walk in.
All right, Onika Raymond, thank you so much, and best wishes with your travel writing, and best wishes in Miami.
Thank you so much.
It wouldn't hurt to bring along a heavy sweater and maybe pack some waterproof boots as we dive deep into Scotland and the things that make it special and apart from the rest of Britain. Two tour guide friends who live in the Fife region of Scotland join us next on Travel with Rick Steves. A little later in the hour, singer Jim Malcolm, who lives in nearby Perthshire, pays homage to Scotland's national poet Robert Burns. Hey, Rick Steves here. In 1978, I was a 23-year-old piano teacher dreaming of the fabled hippie trail from Istanbul to Kathmandu. With my buddy Gene, we booked the tickets, packed our rucksacks, and set out on the adventure of a lifetime. My new book, On the Hippie Trail, features my 60,000-word journal and vivid photos of my coming-of-age trip. Squeeze into rickshaws, sail the sacred Ganges, and look into the eyes of the Virgin Goddess as you stow away with me on the legendary Hippie Trail. You can pre-order my book, On the Hippie Trail, right now by following the link at ricksteves.com. And if you do, I'll send you a postcard with access to special bonus content.
So I'm Anne Doig. I live in Edinburgh, the capital of Scotland, and I lead tours all around Scotland. And each area of Scotland has got very strong local traditions and dialects. Up in the northeast, it's called the Doric. And my grandfather spoke the Doric and standard English. You would not understand somebody with Doric speaking to you. And one example is this, and it goes, fit, fit, fits, fit, fit. Fit in the Doric is what? And fit also means foot. And so it's which or what foot fits what or which foot, meaning your boot. Fit, fit, fits, fit, fit.
Scotland is a little country that packs a big punch, and a proud identity unites its sparse but feisty population. Kilts, bagpipes, whiskey, caber tossing, haggis, poetry, all of these compete for Scotland's top icon. But what do these icons mean to the Scots today? And how do we understand Scotland today beyond the stereotypes? I'm joined by two guides right now from Scotland, Liz Lister and Helen Houston, who I'm sure are both clad in plaid right now, prepared to talk about Scottish identity today. Liz, Helen, thanks so much for being here.
Thanks for inviting us.
Thank you very much.
Probably not clad in plaid, but that rhymed and I wanted to say it. But I think metaphorically you're clad in plaid because you both celebrate your Scottish identity in such a beautiful way.
It's like Liz Lister, tongue twister.
Liz Lister, tongue twister. That's interesting. Yeah, that is a tongue twister in itself. Do Scottish is there a Scottish term for tongue twister, or do you say tongue twister?
I think we just say tongue twister,
tongue
yes.
Tongue twister. If Robbie Burns was going to share a tongue twister, what do you think it would be?
Many a mickle, Max a muckle. That's it. Many a mickle, Max a muckle. Which
what
means
is that?
Look after the pennies and the pounds will look after themselves. All the little bits add up to something big.
There you go. I had a hunch there might be a Robbie Burns tongue twister with a little dose of wisdom. There's so much wisdom that comes out of Scottish folk culture. So Liz, tell me about how you sort out your national loyalty. I just love working with you and you help me research my Scotland guidebook and so on. Do you consider yourself Scottish or British, or how do you sort that out?
Well, I think in Scotland, a significant proportion, up at some polls at 80%, of Scots see themselves as Scottish first and British second. And then, you know, what tends to be classed overseas as English is horrific to Scots. About 2% would see themselves as English or European even. They don't see themselves as European. Now, that's not to say that we're all fierce, passionate, independent-seeking Scots, but it is a very, very strong cultural identity of being Scottish. We recognise ourselves as being different from the rest of the UK in a proud way, in a positive way.
Sure. And I mean, people should remember English and British are two different things also, aren't they?
Absolutely. Yeah. But some people can forget that overseas.
Yeah. So remember, British is much broader. Yeah, I mean, a Welsh person and a Scottish person and an English person.
And Northern
generally
Ireland.
Would be British and Northern Ireland as well. Hey, Helen, if I was to ask you, where are you from? What would you say? Britain or Scotland?
Definitely from Scotland.
So just
just like Liz, I'm Scottish first and British second.
Yeah. And within Scotland, you've got regional variations as well. Liz, how would you divide Scotland as far as cultural regions?
Well, I think that the thing that most differentiates the regions is the dialect. So language is a very strong means of identifying culture and identity. And so across Scotland, we have a range. If you come to Glasgow, as some people probably have, you know, they can find the Glaswegian accent a bit challenging when they're chatting with Ouijis. They may go up to Aberdeen. Fit-like means how are you? So very strong Doric language up in Aberdeen in the northeast. Huh. But then, of course, you also have the two languages of Scotland, because traditionally the Highlands would have spoken Gaelic. And so nowadays, after a significant decline in Gaelic, we're finding that there's a resurgence. We have Gaelic schools where the medium of education is Gaelic. It's not just that it's a language that's taught. The whole curriculum is taught in Gaelic. So Gaelic is particularly up in the Western Isles and the Highlands and Islands of Scotland, real resurgence of Gaelic, which perhaps is not the case down in the Lowlands where they would have traditionally spoken Old Scots or Lallans. And that was really frowned upon because down in the Lowlands of Scotland, that was seen as Northern Britain. And so it was not fashionable to be speaking Lowland Scots. You had elocution lessons to make sure that you spoke as a Northern Britisher, not as a Scot.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah. The language is really a driving force there that identifies the regions, it sounds like. And of course, you got the big cities, you got Edinburgh. And then I like how you can refer to the people from Glasgow as not Glaswegians, but Ouijis, right?
Yeah.
And then, but Highland, I think a lot of our romantic ideas of Scotland come from the Highland culture up in the north. But there's a lot of population south of Edinburgh. Is that called the Borders or the Lowlands or what?
Well, the borders are south of Edinburgh, but the main population in Scotland is in what we call the Central Belt, which is if you draw a line between Glasgow and Edinburgh and take about 30 miles north and about 20 miles south, that 50-mile band, that's where the majority of the population is. And that's where, you know, the Scots would be speaking Old Scots. If you think of Rabbi Burns's poetry, that is mostly written in Old Scots. That's the Central Belt.
This is Travel with Rick Steves, and we're taking a closer look at Scottish identity right now with our guides Helen Houston and Liz Lister. Liz and Helen have been guiding in Scotland for many years. During the pandemic, when tourism came to a halt, they took their Blethers, or chats, to an audience, and the Scottish Blethers podcast was born. You can learn more about that anywhere you get your podcasts. Just look for Scottish Blethers, B-L-E-T-H-E-R-S. Helen, you know, when I travel to Ireland, I'm so aware of the famous Irish diaspora. You know, with the famine and hard times, so many Irish people left. And today, I believe there's 30 million Americans with Irish heritage. What about Scotland? And what about tough times in Scotland's past? Did that result in a kind of diaspora for the Scottish people?
Yes, very much so, very much so. One of the first ones would be around about the mid-1700s, after what some of our listeners will know of the Jacobite uprisings, when the Battle of Culloden changed life in Scotland completely, got rid of the clan system, and many people were either forced out, just as they were in Ireland during the famine, or went voluntarily over to Canada, America at that time. And then again, it's not so well known, but Scotland did suffer a famine about the same time. The same potato blight was in Scotland as in Ireland. And so many Scots were starving, but not to the extent they were in Ireland, because they weren't so totally dependent on the potato. There were other things. And many of the landowners were quite helpful to them. And then later on, they went out to Canada. There was free passages almost to Canada and land grabs given out.
You know, Liz, what Helen was just saying reminded me of, I think I was on the Isle of Skye, and I learned that there were landowners, absentee landowners, that found it a little more profitable and a little less headaches to have sheep instead of human beings on their property. And they figured out ways of getting rid of the people so they could just have the animals.
Yeah, that was the days of the great white sheep, which had been really successful down in the borders, a breed of sheep, big white meaty sheep. And to be able to feed it up and make the profit that the new landowners were looking for, they had to move the people from the best land. So they moved them to the coast, and they put them working in industries like kelp farming, where they were standing waist deep in freezing water, gathering baskets of kelp, which the landowners then sold at great profit, because the time of Napoleonic Wars, there was no potash. And so they needed alkaline material for glass and soap making. And then, of course, when the war ended, they didn't need that. And so the people were homeless. They had no industry. And so that's when you started to see people going voluntarily and then forcibly. But you mentioned there about icons at the beginning of the, you've reamed off a whole load of Scottish stereotypes, the haggis and the caber and all of the rest of it. One of our icons is the thistle. And I always think of it as reflecting the diaspora of Scotland, because if you think of a thistle head, when you blow it, the seeds go carried away on the wind. And that's exactly what happened to the Scots all over the world.
Perfect. What a great metaphor. And when I was thinking of those icons and I was hearing of how Helen described this hard and sad history, I wondered, do you think one reason Scotland embraces the icons of its culture so much is it has to cling to something when it's an uphill battle just to survive as a culture? When you think of the hard times when you couldn't even play the bagpipes and you couldn't even wear a kilt after a certain war when the English wanted to keep down the indigenous Scottish people. Does that contribute to the fury with which the Scottish people hang on to their icons?
I think there's very mixed feelings about that, because a lot of people think that we should be moving forward, and they get annoyed when you see places like Loch Ness and Drumnadrochit with all the tourist hat, the tartan and the kilts and the towels in the form of kilts and all of that. But when they do surveys across the world, they find that those stereotypes don't do us any harm, but they have to be seen in the context of a modern Scotland.
So some of our stereotypes, our icons, like our landscape, our mountains, our scenery, our warmth of our people, they are positive and should be continued, but in a modern context.
That's the challenge, I think, is to have them continue respecting the traditions and still in a modern context. This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're talking with Helen Houston and Liz Lister. They're our guides today as we learn more about Scottish identity and Scottish icons. If you'd like to hear more from Liz and Helen, they've got a wonderful podcast. It's called Scottish Blethers, B-L-E-T-H-E-R-S. So, Helen and Liz, let's talk for a minute about these stereotypes. What would you as tour guides like travelers to understand when they come to Scotland about these things? I'm just going to say the icon and you can share it. Liz, tell us about kilts and tartan.
Well, obviously, a large part of Scottish heritage and still going strong today. Anyone can have their own tartan. Shrek's got a tartan. Corporations have got tartans. All you need to do is get your own tartan designed and have it registered with the Registry of Tartans and off you go. So very much a thing of the past when it was all down to the dyes in the local area, put into the wool and made the colours of the tartan, which took on regional patterns right up to Queen Victoria and tartanry, which was all about the resurgence of Scotland after it had gone through a period of decline that we talked about.
And there was a time in the Romantic age, the Victorian age, when British royalty was kind of charmed by the Scottish culture and chose to have Balmoral Castle, and there was a sort of a resurgence of traditional Scottish icons. Helen, can you talk a little bit about that romantic resurgence of Scotland from a British point of view?
Yes, it was Queen Victoria who really fell in love with Scotland, and she bought Balmoral, as you say, and it was really with Victoria and Albert that tartan came back into the fore. And of course, Sir Walter Scott was very much Victoria's idol as well. And he, through his romantic novels, painted this picture of Scotland. And he invited, in 1822, George IV to come up to Scotland. Now, that was the first time a British monarch had come up to Scotland since all the troubles in the early 1700s. And Sir Walter Scott persuaded George IV to wear tartan, to clad himself from top to toe in tartan, in a kilt, a jacket and everything. George IV didn't quite like his legs under a kilt, so he's reputed to have worn pink stockings under his kilt, which caused quite a stir.
It's quite striking to think of a British royal wearing tartan.
Yes. Well, when they're up in Scotland, they tend to wear tartan. But even, you know, ordinary people wear tartan nowadays. If you go to a Scottish wedding where both the bride and groom are from Scotland, you'll probably find about 75 to 80% of the men are all wearing kilts, tartan outfits. And most men will have their own kilts because that's what they do. My son got his kilt out for his 21st birthday, for example. That was a kind of a traditional thing to do.
And Liz, when you see King Charles wearing a kilt, how does the Scottish person react to that? What do you see when the king is wearing a kilt?
That's it. He is at home in it. He's comfortable in wearing it. It's interesting that William has said he'll never wear a kilt. That's good. You know, it's individual choice. It doesn't mean that he's any less pro-Scottish. But actually, if you go to any high street today, where all the tourist shops are, you'll see that competing with the tartan nowadays, we have Harris Tweed. And it's interesting because you were talking there about the landowners and the harsh conditions that some of them implemented on their land. But many of them tried to introduce industry to give food and money to the tenants. And one of those was the Countess of Dunmore. And she realised that the people on the Western Isles and Harris particularly were producing this warm woolen material called tweed. And she took it down to London, to fashionable London. And before you knew it, there was an industry in Harris Tweed. And that's still going strong today with the Orb. Just like cheddar cheese and French champagne, it can't be called Harris Tweed unless it's made on the island of Harris.
On the island of Harris. And I think I remember being, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think I was on the north end of Skye looking out. And somebody said, that's Harris, the island of Harris. I thought, Harris Tweed.
Yes, right, you have to visit magnificent islands.
Yeah. Liz, can you, as a bletherer or a tour guide, give us a little context of the Highland Games? It's, to me, it's such a beautiful celebration of Scottish culture.
Well, you've attended your own Highland Games with me, Rick, and you entered into a number of races. You've tried to lift the stone, yeah? And it's a festival of strength, feats of strength, piping, Highland dancing, speed. In the old days, it was started by Malcolm III, who was trying to find out the fleetest foot messenger and the strongest man to have in his band of servants.
I was wondering about that. I thought there must be a warrior, old-fashioned military kind of excuse for these games.
Yeah, but one of the best things is that they're usually situated in beautiful locations where you have hill races and other sports. So, you know, it's a real festival.
Yeah, I'll never forget with you. I didn't want to go to the big famous ones that are on TV. I wanted a small town clan gathering. And you knew just the right one when we were visiting with our TV crew. And we were able to have a beautiful day filming that. And I'll never forget the guys taking off on their fell running. And they were gone. And then quite a long time later, they'd come back in having run all over the hills. This has been so much fun talking to both of you about Scotland. I want to remind people that you've really enjoyed this podcast, and it was sort of born out of the time when we couldn't travel, and you thought you would share it with your travelers as a regular podcast, Scottish Blethers, B-L-E-T-H-E-R-S. And I know one of the topics that is reoccurring is the word of the week on your podcast. Can we finish our conversation like you finish your blethers with a word of the week? What would you guys like to share?
Well, having been involved in all of this, I would say that I'm fair puggled. I'm tired out.
Pubbled.
Puggled. P-U-G-G-L-E-D. Fair puggled. Very
puggled.
Tired. Yes.
Well, you just anti-puggled me. You energized me. And Helen, what's your word of the week?
Well, I would say that we've had very, very dreich weather the past few weeks.
Dreich. What is dreich?
D-R-E-I-C-H. Dreich means just dull, rainy, miserable, dreich. A fabulous word that just describes it.
Oh.
Much better than dull, just dreich.
Well, Helen Houston and Liz Lister, you bring sunshine to me when we can talk about Scotland. So best wishes in your dreich weather and best wishes with your continued blethers. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Rick.
Thank you, Rick. Thank you.
Helen Houston tells us what it's like to visit the island of St. Kilda, whose only full-time inhabitants are sheep. It's in a short extra from today's interview. You can hear it with this week's show at ricksteves.com/radio. Our celebration of Scottish culture continues as we visit with singer Jim Malcolm and hear what poet Robbie Burns means to his fellow Scots. Hi, it's Travel with Rick Steves. Each year on January 25th, Scottish people all around the world gather to honor their much-loved poet from the 18th century, Robert Burns. They celebrate what they call a Burns Night Supper. A while back, we invited Scottish folk singer Jim Malcolm to join us on Travel with Rick Steves. He was traveling between concert gigs, and our studio near Seattle was just on the way. Jim Malcolm specializes in turning many of Burns' lyrics into music, and joins us now to help all of us enjoy what Robbie Burns means to the Scots. Jim, welcome back to Travel with Rick Steves.
Oh, it's great to be back in the Pacific Northwest.
Nice to have you here, and it must be fun to share the passion for Robbie Burns to a lot of Scottish Americans and honorary Scottish Americans.
You know, it's very flattering, actually, just how loved this guy who lived in Scotland all these years ago is.
What is it about Robert Burns? I mean, there's a lot of great poets you got, you know, in Scotland and beyond, but Robbie Burns, it just makes anybody who loves Scotland stand up and put their hand in their heart.
I remember when I was studying philosophy when I was a student, you talked about modern philosophy being footnotes to Plato, and that Plato sort of like just coined everything and the rest was just froth. Well, with Scottish culture, it's like, Robert Burns is like, you know, it's like Scottish culture is footnotes to Burns. He codified, you know, he kind of...
And this was after the terrible defeat of the Scottish rebels against the English, right? And this was when Scotland was being downtrodden by the English Empire, but he brought Scottish pride and recognition and romanticized it even.
He was one of quite a number of people, musicians and writers and thinkers and academics who were worried that the Scottish culture was being eroded.
Right.
And one of the ways that he thought that he could preserve a lot of the beautiful melodies was to enshrine them in songs.
So there is a connection with music and poetry and Scottish nationalism all in Robbie Burns.
I mean, he wrote some cracking songs about this whole war really between England and Scotland that had happened hundreds of years before,
right.
You know, Robert the Bruce.
So he wrote the music and the lyrics?
No, he was more a lyricist, you know.
Okay.
He would start off with a good tune.
What's a good example? Can you give us an example of some way where music and Burns poetry all comes together well?
Yeah, he was in a pub in Edinburgh somewhere, and he heard an old man playing this beautiful slow air on the fiddle.
Mm-hmm.
And he thought the man looked so frail, you know, that he needed to get this tune from him and write a song around it and preserve it. And that's Auld Lang Syne. And this is actually the original melody, because the melody that is now sung is different.
Huh.
It's more kind of straight. It's more, should all the acquaintance be forgot a happy new year. But this is the original melody. Should all the acquaintance be forgot and never brought to mind. Should all the acquaintance be forgot for all Lang Syne, for Auld Lang Syne, my Jo, for Auld Lang Syne, we'll tak a cup of kindness yet, for Auld Lang Syne.
This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're joined by Jim Malcolm, who's a Scottish troubadour, and we're talking about the impact today of the poetry and the spirit of Robert Burns and the music related to that. Jim, that was beautiful. Now, did I understand that was an air, a violin solo Burns himself would have heard in a pub?
Yep. That's how he worked.
And people, he loved the melody, and he thought, I need to enshrine this in Scottish culture somehow.
And so once he became renowned for doing this, people would send him melodies.
Tunes.
You know? Yeah.
So the tune would survive if it had great lyrics to it, or it would be a way to immortalize it.
That's kind of the way that it has worked.
That is the way it works.
Yeah. You know, the tunes and words kind of find each other. Sometimes it's the other way around. Sometimes it starts with the poem and the words, the tune jumps on top of it, you know?
You know, if you feel this when you're in Scotland, this passion, this... I just love traveling in so many ways because you meet people who really, they know every little peak on the horizon. They know the history of everything they're drinking. They know their national poets. They tie it into their music. What is it about Robert Burns' poetry that really endears him to a Scottish person?
Just the immediacy of his writing, you know, he just gets to the, when he wants to talk about love, he goes straight for the jugular. If he wants to have fun, he could write anything. He could, you know, if Robert Burns had been alive today, he'd have been straight to Hollywood making musicals. And,
right,
you know,
right.
He would have been absolutely.
So this
just
was kind of pop culture in its day.
Yeah, but he was brilliant. You know, he was.
Is there something, you're a songwriter, is there something you've written that was inspired by some piece of poetry that you loved from Robert Burns that works together?
I have actually written a tune to a very long poem that he wrote called Tam O'Shanter. And I just was so inspired by his poem that I decided to put a tune to the whole thing and you know...
Could you share a little bit of that?
I could do a little bit of it. It goes on and on. I mean...
Just do a little bit, but also translate, because I have a very tough time with the Scottish.
Well, you know, this is... It would take as long to translate it as...
what's the gist of what we're going to be
hearing? The gist of it is this guy called Tam O'Shanter, who's a drunk, and he's at the pub, and he is so drunk that when he goes home on this terrible, terrible stormy night, he comes across an old haunted church with witches and warlocks dancing and the devil, you know, playing the bagpipes and stuff. And he gets completely carried away with this one beautiful witch to the point that he actually shouts out through the window, "Weel done, Cutty Sark," which means "well done, short skirt." And
Cutty Sark is short skirt.
Well, it's a sark is actually more like a vest, but
okay.
we wear our vests under our shirts. It's kind of undershirt. Anyway, it's one of these things that different from you guys.
So, when you described that, I could see if I was a poet stepping into some of these almost haunted churches in Scotland and be inspired to write that. I was just in one in Inverness.
Yeah.
Jim Malcolm, let's hear a little bit of Robert Burns and Scottish folk music.
When Chapman Bellies leave the street, and through thin neighbours meet, when market days are waiting late, and folk begin to tack the gate, as we sit boozing at the nappy, and getting fooling unca happy, we think now on the long Scots miles, the mosses or water slaps and stiles that lie between us and our hame, for sits a sulking sullen dame, gathering her brows like a gathering storm, and nursing her wrath to keep it warm. This troop and honest tam o' shanter, as he free airy nichted canter, all their wonder tune surpasses, for honest men and bonny lasses. O tam, hast thou but been sae wise, and told thy ain wife Kate's advice? She told thee well a Worcester skellum, a blither and bluster and drunken blellum, that frae November till October, I market day now was na sober, ilka milner with a miller, thou sat as long as thou had silla, every nag was ca'd a shoe on, smith and thee got a roaring a foo on, at the Lord's house even on a Sunday, thou drank wi' Kirk and Jean till Monday, she prophesied that later soon thou would be found deep drowned in doon, or catched by the mark of Allawa's old haunted kirk. Oh, gentle dames at gars me greet, to think how many counsels sweet, how many length and sage advices, the husband frae the wife despises. And it just goes on and on to describe his journey
yeah.
to the...
Well, it's the poems can go on and on in the music, and it just, it's, I can see it in a pub, getting everybody together. This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're listening to Jim Malcolm singing Scottish folk music, specifically inspired by the great Scottish poet Robert Burns. To hear more of Jim's music, you can go to his website at jimmalcolm.com. Jim, when I was listening to you, even though I didn't understand the old Scottish, it reminded me what a passion Scottish people have for lyrics and words. I mean, great poets, great writers, great passion for communicating with the word. You're a songwriter.
Well,
what is it about Scotland and the word?
Well, my wife is probably the most pedantic person you will ever meet. I have to pronounce all my words properly.
Yeah? You know, so pronounce them properly in Scottish?
Yeah, you know, it's just, I remember I was getting exasperated with her once, and I said, you know, you really are the high priest of pedantry. And she said, priestess.
That's right. That's bingo.
So, well, yeah, people get very passionate about the language. They just, it's
well,
kind of, yeah.
And when you think about it, I can't think of many countries that have actually like a national holiday for the birthday of their favorite poet. I mean, what, January 25th is Robert Burns
That's right.
Day. And
no,
every
no,
year,
no, no, Robert Burns Night.
Robert Burns Night.
Night.
What happens
yeah.
on Robert Burns Night in Scotland every January 25th?
Well, it doesn't just happen in Scotland. It happens all over the world.
Right.
And in fact, I was actually performing at a Burns dinner in Chico, California. Last Burns Night. And it's just all the good stuff. People wear their kilts. People play bagpipes. People drink lots of whiskey. They eat haggis. They recite his poems. They dance. They sing. They tell jokes.
Now, you've produced a DVD, which is called Bard Hair Day.
Yeah.
Tell us about that. And you dress up like Robbie Burns and
well,
you play the role.
This was something that I actually did for the 250th anniversary of his birth. I dressed up as Robert Burns. Actually, when I did dress up as Robert Burns, I was a bit shocked at the attention I got. It turned me into a complete babe magnet. And My wife just, she's not too keen.
You know,
on
I'm looking at the cover right now. It's not a, you, with a, after a couple of whiskeys, I think you do have a little resemblance to Robbie Burns. But I was just in the National Gallery, the Portrait Gallery in Edinburgh.
Oh, yes. Yeah,
and there
lovely.
Are beautiful portraits of Robbie Burns. And he must have been a babe magnet back in the 18th century.
Oh, goodness. No, I mean, he had, just by the number of children he had. You know,
well, you can,
he
was always roaming around on the road. I was just in a little hotel in Kenmore, and there was a poem written by him on the chimney in his hand, they say.
Yeah, yeah. And it's not a very good one, actually. It's funny.
You know the one I'm talking about?
Yeah, yeah. Because he.
Yeah,
you know,
I read it thinking, I got to appreciate this better.
You could imagine the people saying, right, Robbie, here's the wall. Write a poem. He's going, with a hangover. He's going, oh, God, your rivers are bonny and your trees are bonny too.
one of the other hits of Robert Burns. We're speaking with Jim Malcolm. We're celebrating Robbie Burns and traditional Scottish folk music. Tell us about what's called Burns Country. How can we splice in a little bit of Robbie Burns into our trip?
Well, Burns Country really extends from Alloway, where he was born, and you can visit his cottage and there's a museum there.
And that's on the west coast of Scotland,
just
across from Ireland.
Yes, it's also close across from the Isle of Arran, which is a lovely island. Mm-hmm. And also Ailsa Craig, which is where all the curling stones in the world come from.
Oh, okay.
From this island, they have this phenomenal granite.
So the island of Arran. Arran mean island in Celtic?
Yeah, there's an Arran Isles in Ireland as well.
Yeah, and it's kind of like Island, isn't
yes,
it?
Yes, yes. Well, it's like the Valley of Strathmore, you know, Strath means valley, the Valley of Valley.
And Avon means river.
Yes.
So you go Avon River, the river, the valley, and the island.
Yeah, yeah, they like to get
Celtic.
It's like, you know, couscous, so good we named it twice, you know. Yeah, and Burns Country extends really down to Dunfries, which is closer to the English border, and that's where he died. And he lived in three different locations in and around Dunfries. So these are the two real hotspots.
So if I'm just travelling around Scotland and I happen to be there on a day when people are thinking about Robbie Burns, can we just close with a song, Jim Malcolm? You're so good with Robert Burns and the music. Troubadour of the Year, Scots Singer of the Year. What would you like to hear if you had me as a visitor in a pub in your hometown?
Well, I'll sing a wee song that Robert Burns wrote about himself.
Oh, great.
Which sounds a bit egotistical. You know, that's enough of me talking of me. What do you think of me? So it's called Rantin' Rovin' Robin. And he basically tells the story of his entry into the world, you know, and what people thought of him and stuff. So I'll sing it for you. There was a lad was born in Kyle, but what in the day or what in the style? I doubt it hardly worth the while to be saying nice way Robin. Robin was a roving boy, rantin' roving, rantin' roving. Robin was a roving boy, rantin' roving, Robin. The monarch's sign most year betain was 25 days begun. Was in a blast of January when blew hands all in on Robin. Robin was a roving boy, rantin' roving, rantin' roving. Robin was a roving boy, rantin' roving, Robin. He'll hame his fortunes great or small, but I a hair to a boon the ma. He'll be a credit to a huzzah, we'll all be proud of Robin. Robin was a roving boy, rantin' roving, rantin' roving. Robin was a roving boy, a rantin' roving, Robin.
Beautiful. To hear more of Jim Malcolm's beautiful Scottish music, go to his website, jimmalcolm.com. Jim, thanks so much. And it just reminds me, when you're in Scotland, don't think of it as a bunch of museums and castles and palaces. You got to save time and energy for the social scene, the musical scene, the cultural scene after dark in the pubs with the traditional music.
After dark. That's why it's called Burns Night.
Burns Night, that's right. Whoa, Robbie Burns, appreciating Scottish trad. Thank you.
You're very welcome. Cheers.
you will find on the road from the castle down to Holyrood a funny little stone set in the cobbles of St. Giles. If you stand for a while, you will surely see a local passing by and spitting at it in a practice style. If he's wearing maroon, he is showing his allegiance to the heart of Midlothian, a loyal, proddy man. If he's wearing the green, he is spitting disobedience as a duty-bound supporter of a Fernian. I can tell you that the flowers of Edinburgh aren't on the floral cock in Prince's Street. They're the quirky little things that old Ricky often brings to remind you of the history beneath your feet. I can tell you that the flowers of Edinburgh aren't just the girls at university. They're the quirky little things that old Ricky often brings to remind you of the history beneath your tail.
Jim and his wife and duet partner Susie Malcolm have released a number of CDs of traditional Scottish ballads and modern songs they've written. Their most recent collection is called Old Tune Shuffle. They plan to hold their annual concert tour of the Western U.S. starting February 7th in Prescott, Arizona. Their tour dates for house concerts and music hall venues take them to New Mexico and from Tucson to San Diego and Santa Monica, up the coast to SoCal, Berkeley, Chico, and Olympia. They'll conclude with a performance in Bellingham, Washington on March 2nd. Details are at jimmalcolm.com. They're also working on plans for touring the eastern and southeastern United States in the early fall.
Travel with Rick Steves is produced by Tim Tatton with Casmara Hall and Donna Bardsley at Rick Steves Europe in Edmonds, Washington. Andrew Wakeling and Sherry Court upload the shows to our website. Sheila Gerzoff handles affiliate promotions. Our theme music is by Jerry Frank. Take a look at Rick's list for what to pack in your suitcase and share tips with fellow travelers. It's part of our online travel forum. It's at ricksteves.com. We'll see you next week with more Travel with Rick Steves.